Hello, former Tech Blitz viewers. I, of course, am Dr. Robert Farley of Patterson School, University of Kentucky. And with me today is Daniel Larrison. How are you doing today, Daniel?
Just fine, Rob. Thanks. How are you?
Fantastic. So what's your affiliation?
Right now I'm a senior editor at the American Conservative magazine, and I also write a column for The Week online.
Right, which is, I mean, I think both of those have become well-known in terms of your contributions to the, of course, we've had you here on I don't think we've had you specifically on Foreign Entanglements before, but you've been on blog, or you and I have done a blogging hit before.
We did last summer. I think it was before Foreign Entanglements came into being. I think it you started your series a little bit later on.
Right, in the prehistory, under the old regime, but this is the first under the new regime. So, today we're going to talk about a couple things. We are going to talk about the speech, the foreign policy speech that Governor Romney gave yesterday at, or was it yesterday or the day before? By the time that this is online, it'll be a couple days ago at VMI. And we're also going to give or do a little bit on the vice presidential debate, the debate between Vice President Biden and Representative Ryan, which will be happening on Thursday evening. I guess so, before we talk about the actual substance of Romney's talk, and I think we'll use Romney's talk to tack to foreign policy more generally, but did you attribute any significance? Well, I'm sure you attributed some significance. What significance did you attribute to the fact that Romney gave this talk at VMI?
You mean the location?
The location of the speech.
I think one thing that he wanted to do was to give a speech in Virginia. Of course, he wanted to emphasize his opposition to any possible reductions in military spending. He was, he's been very adamant about not wanting military spending to go down, and of course, he wants it to increase by trillions over the next 10 years. So he's, I think he's definitely making a pitch for the large number of people connected to military spending, the large number of military bases and armed force personnel that are resident in Virginia. And indeed, I think Virginia Governor McDonnell made a point of listing the numbers of all of the different members of the service and all of the veterans who live in Virginia as a way of saying, really broadcasting, this is why he's in Virginia giving this speech. I think going to VMI, it was intended to be a friendly audience, a receptive audience to what he was going to say.
Right. I mean, that's my side. I mean, because Virginia has, for mysterious reasons, become, I guess not terribly mysterious reasons, but has become a swing state in this election, that it's not terribly difficult to explain him going to VMI and giving a speech. It's, you know, it's a as you suggested, a friendly. A friendly audience, it's good atmospherics, it's in a swing state, there's no Ohio Military Institute, or at least none that I'm familiar with. And sort of, it gave him the opportunity to invoke George Marshall, which I know that some people have taken some significance. Of course, George Marshall was effectively the predecessor of the modern chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and also Secretary of State under under Truman. I mean, I guess, do you have any thought? Why don't I just open up to you? What are your thoughts on the speech, on the invocation of Marshall, sort of more broadly on the argument for higher defense spending and whatever else was in there? I guess, what struck you about the speech?
Okay, well, to start with the Marshall invocation, or the use of Marshall in the speech, it reflects, I think, based on what Romney's advisors have been saying to the press, it reflects this conceit that they have, that they belong to the bipartisan foreign policy tradition going back to the start of the Cold War, and that supposedly Obama and Carter, those are the only ones that don't belong to that tradition, because this is, again, the forced effort to make Obama into a Carter clone and to say that Obama is somehow wildly out of step with that tradition, which, as we know, is not accurate. And so the reliance on Marshall is a way of tapping into this idea that Obama has somehow separated himself from the democratic foreign policy tradition as represented by Truman and Marshall and those like them. And Romney is trying to appropriate that and say, I'm the only one who represents this sort of vision for America and the world. And Obama is some sort of, I don't know if they want to paint him as a McGovernite or how they want to portray him exactly.
Well, I mean, as a couple of people have pointed out, you know, Marshall was the subject of just brutal, withering critique from the right wing in the late 1940s and the 1950s, particularly with regards to U.S. China policy.
Sure.
And, you know, it's not terribly difficult, at least for me, to see echoes of that critique in sort of more broadly the foreign policy discussions of John Bolton and so forth and some others who are at least associated with the Romney campaign, right? I mean, they seem far closer to me to Marshall's foes in the 1950s than they do to Marshall. But I guess that's, you know, why Romney is taking this time to position himself as in the Marshallian tradition.
Sure. Well, and you're seeing, I think, in the way that Romney is trying to position himself as always being more hawkish than Obama, more aggressive. He really does fit more into that that line of the critics, for example, the early critics of containment, the early advocates of rollback, who always see any sort of limitation or restraint on the part of the U.S. as a signal of weakness, which is almost always a horrible diagnosis of the situation.
Right. It's an attitude towards foreign policy that, as I think, again, a few other people have pointed out, relies very heavily on the notions of resolve, will, and credibility. Right. That if we merely express a sufficient degree of resolve, or to frame it in sort of masculine terms, toughness, that a whole variety of foreign policy outcomes will simply fall into line. And so things like the reset with Russia, or any sort of conciliation towards Iran, or you know, even something so far as picking up the phone, and I don't believe Obama has done this, but picking up the phone and congratulating President Chavez on his win would be seen as weakness, as an invitation to America's enemies, who of course understand the interdependence of global commitments, and therefore some significant reduction in America's global power. I mean, I think that's come through fairly clearly in Romney's understanding of foreign policy, or at least how he's talked about foreign policy.
Sure, and this is bound up with his constant tropes of talking about not apologizing. Of course, there wasn't any apologizing going on, but he's very much against anything that could be in any way construed as that.
If I interrupt there for a second, and I want to bring up the apology thing because, I mean, it has become commonplace to point out the accuracy of the claim that Obama has not actually apologized for very much of anything. At the same time, do you think that there is any fairness or truth to the conservative line on Obama that even to the extent that there is no direct statement of apologies, that there is sort of a broader ecology of apology with regards to at least some of his discussion of foreign affairs, right? And so, and I'm sure what they would be thinking when they think about apology tour and so forth is that even though he's not saying it outright, he is in essence, and everyone understands this essence, that he is in essence apologizing for the administration of George W. Bush, and that this was the case back in 2009 and 2010. I mean, do you think that there's any...
There could be something to that.
Mm-hmm, right.
Because I think one of the things that it informed the way that Obama and his advisors came to many foreign policy issues is the assumption that Bush had severely damaged relations with other countries, had severely damaged America's reputation in the world, and that was the damage that they were there to repair. And And sometimes that's been more successful in some places, less so in others. But so yeah, I think there, if you put it that way, there is an attempt on their part to try to make up or compensate for the damage that was done under Bush, and to try to distinguish themselves, at least on the level of style or rhetoric, from the way that Bush conducted affairs abroad. But then I guess I have difficulty seeing why that would be a problem, right? I mean, so
Right.
even if you want to characterize that as an apology tour, there were things that Bush did that needed to be apologized for, that needed to be corrected. And indeed, one of the constant complaints about Obama is that he hasn't done enough to correct from the Bush record, right? I mean, this is the complaint from progressives, this is the complaint from libertarians, that Obama has retained far too much of the Bush record for their comfort, and indeed far too much, far, far more than is good for the US.
Right. And I mean, I think I would sort of, broadly speaking, I would concur with that critique, while at the same time sort of recognizing how conservatives understand this apology, right? That understanding what they mean when they are talking about apology tour is different sort of than the very literal readings that we're sometimes applying to it.
Right.
With regards to the Romney speech, I mean, he talked certainly in generalities about increasing the defense budget or at least suspending cuts to the defense budget. Do you have any thoughts or did, I mean, it wasn't just that, it was also distributional issues, right? He also specifically talked about, or at least he gave some inclination on what the specifics were with regards to what a future military would look like. And he especially, and this is partially because he's in Virginia, but I think it's also because, I mean, this has been a recurrent theme in the campaign. He talked about naval affairs. He
Right.
talked about that the Navy should be getting larger, that more ships should be getting built, and so forth. And do you have any thoughts on that specifically? On, you know, not necessarily the we're spending more, but the how monies given to the Pentagon should or ought to be redistributed, and how the Romney campaign's thinking about that?
Well, I think the way that they've usually framed the call for more shipbuilding, first of all, of course, they come up with the figure that the number of ships has reached some sort of record low, which of course doesn't take into account the kinds of ships that there are. But so there, on the one hand, there is a sort of a, I think, just a fetishization of needing a really big navy because we had a big navy under Reagan and we need to have another one, just because. But to the extent that there is a rationale for it, it seems to be directed towards maintaining preeminence in the Western Pacific and being a response to the perceived dangers from Chinese territorial claims or Chinese ambitions in East Asia and in Southeast Asia. So it seems to be that it's directed there most of all. Although obviously it could have other applications.
Right. It could have sort of broader, I mean, it could sort of play into a more general set of or desire in displaying resolve, displaying toughness, displaying credibility around the world by sort of always being present. I mean, does this, well, I guess, following this up, do you see a Romney administration actually going through with an increase in defense spending? Or is this just talk at this point, or do you think they're actually going to do this?
I think that many of the people on the campaign would like to do this. Whether they can actually get the votes and find the funding for it, is another question. One of the big contradictions in the Romney-Ryan campaign is that on the one hand they want to present themselves as these new voices of fiscal responsibility. Whether you find that credible or not is another question. But they want to present themselves that way, and then on the other hand, they want this massive expansion of the military budget that's simply not going to be possible given their other fiscal priorities. So something's going to give. In the past, in past Republican administrations, when there has had to be a choice between reducing spending overall or expanding the military budget, usually expanding the military budget wins. And so that seems to be, I would assume that the same sort of thing would happen again. But it would depend on how many Democrats in the Senate are willing to go along with that expansion. There might be enough to go along with it so that it would be possible to pass it. But yes, I think they definitely want to do it. Yeah.
Right. I mean, the big exception to that rule from GOP presidents would be George H.W. Bush, who both cut the defense budget and raised taxes. what did you think of the very interventionist noises that Romney made in the speech with regards to Syria, or at least with regards to increasing support for Syrian rebels? I mean, what did you make of that? Is this...
I think it's
something he's serious about, or just a critique of Obama that he's developed?
I think he's taken that position public because, and he'd adopted this position earlier, but he hadn't included it in a speech before, I think. And he's taking it public and making it part of his argument for himself. I think in part to placate people within his own party who think that more needs to be done in Syria. But I think it's also a signal that Romney is very eager about announcing his intention to become more involved in Syria, whereas Obama, even if he's doing some of the things that Romney's talking about, he really doesn't want to broadcast it, and he's not interested in encouraging people to find more reasons to get involved. I think it's a signal to his own people that he's open to more involvement in Syria than Obama would be, and he wants people to think of that as a selling point, which is strange because it's extremely unpopular. All of the options that are available are massively unpopular. Nobody wants to be involved in Syria. But for that small contingent of people who do like what he's saying, this is an encouraging sign, and I think it's meant to encourage them. The Wall Street Journal this morning just had an op-ed, but this is on Tuesday morning, an op-ed congratulating Romney on his speech, but being a little bit disappointed that he didn't call for even more aggressive measures in Syria, which they would clearly prefer. And I think that's a good sign of the kinds of pressures he's going to face if he does win the election. He'll be getting constant pressure from the hawks within his party and from interventionists such as those on the Wall Street Journal editorial board, constantly berating him for not doing enough until he finally gives in and starts a military intervention of some kind.
Right, and I mean, let's be frank, too. I mean, if he becomes president, he may well even begin receiving fire from liberal hawks on the other side, right? It wouldn't be at all surprising. Once they no longer have the responsibility of power, and once they no longer have the responsibility of actually having to do something with Syria, if they were to intervene, you could see some people who are now in the Obama administration harshly critiquing Romney in action on Syria if he doesn't actually intervene. Right? That wouldn't surprise me at all.
Sure, and he's, in a way, he's setting himself up for that sort of attack with the way that he has been constantly pressing for more action on Syria, more action on Iran. He's inviting people on the other side to treat his policies in exactly the same way, which they would have anyway, but he's definitely made it much easier for them to throw these words back in his face and say, you say that you believe in leadership as defined by an activist and interventionist policy, well, then follow up on what you promised.
Right. Was there anything else in the speech that leapt out at you or that struck you as particularly interesting? And let's not even limit us to the speech. I guess start with the speech, but then just sort of go from there, and we can talk more, about other interesting bits of Romney foreign policy. So.
Sure. One of the things that I did notice, I didn't really notice it the first time that I heard it when I was watching it, when I went back and reread it, is that there's almost nothing about anything outside of North Africa and the Middle East, unless you count Afghanistan. I mean, there's really nothing that addresses issues in Europe, Latin America, East Asia. I mean, he gives them very brief passing mentions. And we know he has views about these things. He's offered them before, but he took this opportunity simply to ignore them, which was curious, I thought, because he has been very, very harsh on criticizing Russia policy. He has been very interested in China bashing on the campaign trail. And he's even tried to make an issue out of Hugo Chavez and Venezuela, of all things, as some sort of important threat that we should be worried about. So there were little nods to that again in one paragraph of the speech, but there was no developed or sustained, not even criticism of what's been going on. Maybe he thinks he's already done that. He doesn't need to do more of it, but it was a curious omission.
Right. I mean, he's had to be. I mean, you're right that he has at times been very hawkish on China, and at other times he has been almost curiously silent. And
right.
I mean, it seems, well, my interpretation of that has always been sort of recognizing that the Republican coalition is deeply divided on relations with China.
Sure.
With sort of the foreign policy elite having a general negative view of China, and the commercial elite having an extremely positive view of China, and especially an extremely positive view of their ongoing commercial relationships with China, and not wanting the foreign policy elite to screw that up. I mean, do you get that sense, or am I interpreting? I mean, do you think that Romney is being forced to tack between those two extremes on China?
I think he's trying to balance it. There are a lot of people who support him in the business world who assume or hope that he's been kidding about all of these things he's been saying about China. Although there are these little anecdotes that keep cropping up here and there. For instance, in the most recent overview of the two candidates' foreign policy views in The Economist, there was this little anecdote about a Romney advisor saying that it's China that generates this visceral reaction in Romney. Romney has this very strong negative reaction to China, particularly in the way that they treat foreign investors or foreign companies. And so in a weird way, Romney's connection to the business world seems to mix together with his hawkish impulses or his impulse to demagogue things, and produces this anti-China position that's informed by his concerns about the way that businesses are treated in China. I think maybe the expectation that he's going to soften his position on China once he's in office may be based on a misunderstanding of what he's of the reason that he is so put out by Chinese policies.
That's interesting. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that, but I mean, yeah, it's very interesting.
And so then you do have people, for instance, you have someone like Kissinger, who's generally interested in accommodation with China, although obviously he's not representative of the people that are surrounding Romney at the moment. Cool. And indeed, Romney's main China advisor, Aaron Friedberg, is pretty much the anti-Kissinger in terms of his views about the way that the U.S. should relate to China.
Right. I mean, we didn't see much of Russia in this speech. It was interesting that not only did Romney, I mean, he didn't mention Venezuela very much, he also didn't mention the recent elections in Georgia, unless I'm completely missing a mention of it. We know that. Well, go ahead, Fire.
So one interesting thing about Romney's position on Russia and his attitude towards ex-Soviet countries in general is that he doesn't seem to have much interest in the countries around Russia, certainly not for their own sake, or even for how they might relate to his vision of a U.S. policy in that part of the world. If Russia's neighbors count for anything, it simply is sort of props that he will
right.
use during his speeches to say, oh, look at Obama abandoning such and such country. Usually it's Poland that he's picking up on.
Right.
One of the curious things is that even though pro-Georgian or pro-Saakashvili rhetoric is very common among Republican hawks who don't like Russia or don't like the reset, Romney, to my knowledge, has never publicly said anything about Georgia one way or the other. He doesn't seem to have it on his radar at all. And so his lack of attention to the Georgian election last week fits into that. And likewise, he has no commitments to NATO expansion either. This is something that was still very much a Republican priority as recently as 2008, even after the war in Georgia. And it's simply gone, not just to the back burner, it's completely gone from the agenda.
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, I hadn't thought about it that way, but I think that you're right. I mean, to the extent we've heard about Eastern Europe at all, it has been simply in the context of Poland. I think you may have mentioned the Czech Republic once or twice.
Sure.
But interchangeably, effectively with Poland, with regards to Obama's abandonment, Obama's apology, and so forth. So, and so I guess maybe then the election in Georgia doesn't really change anything with regards to how we might look at. It doesn't change anything to how we might look at Romney foreign policy, except insofar that it may take expansion of NATO to Georgia off the table.
Possibly, although
the
new Georgian leadership, at least if they're not kidding, if they're not just pretending to be interested in belonging to NATO, they're still very interested in pursuing that. Whether the alliance is actually interested in going ahead and bringing them in is another question. They keep bringing Georgia in sort of by stages and keep promising them more in the future, but I think this may be a case where they just keep postponing it indefinitely in the recognition that it would blow things up with Russia in a way that they really don't want.
Right. Well, and also in recognition of the commitment that, I mean, there has to be some recognition in NATO that A, war might actually happen between Russia and Georgia again, and B,
right.
No one in NATO is faintly interested in defending Georgia from Russia. Right.
That's right.
It's the farthest thing from what anybody in the alliance actually wants. So,
right.
Well, why don't we tack over to what will, assuming this dialogue is published on Thursday. So if you, gentle viewer, are viewing this on Thursday, you're probably anticipating the Biden-Ryan debate tonight. Which, you know, I think a lot of people are looking at as pure entertainment value just because of the fascinating, to me, popular conception of Joe Biden that has emerged to some extent from a caricature on the right and some not caricature on the right, but also from the work of The Onion more broadly, which has created just a magnificent fictional Joe Biden. But it looks to be a very interesting debate. It will almost certainly deal with some foreign policy issues because of that the responsibilities of the office of vice president often involve foreign policy. What are your initial thoughts on what this debate is going to look like between Ryan and Biden tonight?
So I think that, as you say, the foreign policy will figure into it quite a lot. And of course, because it's the only vice presidential debate, they have to cover everything. So it'll be split roughly in half. But for that foreign policy half, I think Biden is going to surprise a lot of his detractors on the right who have developed a sort of mythology about Biden based on his voting record, saying, well, he opposed the Gulf War, he supported the invasion of Iraq, which normally they don't think is a problem, but when they're making fun of Biden, they do. And they try to create this idea that Biden has been consistently wrong about everything. And so who is Joe Biden to talk to anyone about foreign policy experience or foreign policy competence? Opposite him is Ryan, who has very little foreign policy experience, to the extent that he has any. It's based on his voting record in the House, where he supported the Bush administration on pretty much everything it wanted to do. And so it's going to be an interesting clash, I think, because Biden will be able to speak at much greater length and in much greater detail about these things than Ryan. And I think even Ryan and the people around him are aware of that. His supporters are not quite as clued in about this, because based on one or two speeches that Ryan has given, they think that Ryan is supremely capable and knowledgeable about these areas, mainly because he's been saying things that they like to hear, not because of any real expertise that he's demonstrated. In fact, if you go back and look at those speeches, there's really not a whole lot there. They're as famous as they are, or they're as often cited as they are, simply because there are so few other sources for figuring out what Ryan's views are. And so people have to work with what they have. And really what you see from Ryan is this, I don't know if you want to call it simplistic, but a very universalist view of the way the world works or should work. And any accommodation with practical compromises or political compromises is considered to be a form of relativism that he's going to reject and rail against. And I think if he goes down that road and he starts attacking the administration policy in those terms, Biden will be able to paint him as a sort of an ideologue and someone who doesn't really know much about the complexities of international politics. And I think that portrayal might be pretty accurate.
Right. I mean, we have to recollect what happened 4 years ago, right? I mean, Biden really did extremely well against someone who's probably not as capable of a debater as Paul Ryan is, but who has some of the same characteristics, right? A set of simplistic views about foreign policy. Obviously I'm biased, but all that went through my head the entire time was that one of these people is qualified to be president, one of them is not. And that was true about 5 minutes into the debate. And when that one person is Joe Biden, it was very interesting. But Biden did a very good job. And I think that as a lot of people have suggested or have sort of, to some extent, joked about, Biden has been having these debates since 1900, right? That he has been a part of presidential politics for a very long time, and long, broad experience in foreign policy. I mean, how does this? I mean, normally with debate expectations, and you certainly saw this with the presidential debate last week. Normally with debate expectations, partisans make undertake an effort to dampen down expectations. But in this case, it does look to me like there are high expectations that Ryan will simply wipe the floor with Biden. I mean, how does that come about? Is it just from this sort of popular interpretation of Biden and Biden's career that is perhaps at some odds with reality? And is it just because as you suggested, Ryan has been telling these audiences what they want to hear? Or is there some sort of systematic underestimation of Joe Biden as a politician?
I think there is some of that in terms of underestimating him, because he will often say silly or easily mocked things, usually when he's speaking extemporaneously on the stump or when he's campaigning or something like that. There seems to be an assumption that he'll do things like that, but there's no real evidence that he's made huge mistakes like that during a debate. So he's actually quite disciplined and on message usually when he's debating. So I think there is a misconception about who Biden is in the debate format. Sort of in the same way that I think a lot of people going into the debate had a misunderstanding of how effective Romney could be in that sort of controlled setting. Whereas when he's not in a controlled setting, he often fumbles or ends up saying things that are easily criticized.
I mean, there was such a, and I was surprised at the surprise at how effective Romney was, because there is such a difference between a debate between, you know, two individuals who both have a pretty good command of policy issues, which is what last week was, and the sort of debate that Romney was in during the GOP primary, where he's up there with a bunch of people who, it's a much different setting, right? And it was predictable that Romney would be much more effective in a one-on-one with Obama than he was. And he wasn't even particularly ineffective during the GOP debates, but that this was an environment that Romney was extremely well suited to. And you know, consequently, he did very, very well.
Right. And I think there, and now because Romney has done so well, and there was already this belief that Ryan is a super policy expert, there is, I think, even higher expectations for Ryan than there were before last week, and those were already quite high, and which overlooks the fact that Ryan has never been in a debate at this level, in this sort of setting, and in fact the opposition he's had in his House races has not been very strong, so I don't think he's accustomed to facing off against someone in that kind of setting with the sort of stakes that will be up for grabs on Thursday.
Do you know who is he debating? Is he practicing against any proxy Joe Biden? Do you have any idea who that might be?
The proxy Joe Biden is Ted Olson, the former Solicitor General, and I guess according to reports, Olson has even been practicing Biden mannerisms. So I guess Ryan will be prepared for some of that. But I think the real problem for Ryan is that he's credited with being such a wonk, by people who admire him, that that he's going to be, he's almost bound to disappoint them, and he's bound to be coming out of this debate looking a little bruised and beaten, I think, because once again, as he was in his convention speech, he's going to have to make the partisan argument or the argument of the attack dog that isn't always going to mesh very well with the reputation of being a supposed truth teller, right? This is the reputation that he cultivated for all those months and years before he was picked, which he then proceeded to trash in the space of one evening.
All right. Well, before we close, I mean, we are now less than a month away from the election. You know, I think for both of us, foreign policy, you know, I'm sure we bring a lot of different priors to the election. But is there anything you see happening in the next not quite a month on the foreign stage or in how foreign policy is depicted in the United States that will have a significant effect? And I don't mean just will it flip Virginia or something like that, but will have a significant effect on how the narrative of foreign policy plays out in this election. Are there any exogenous or endogenous factors that sort of you're looking at, that things that could happen in the next month that could be consequential for how we look back at this election?
That's a good question. My guess is, if there were anything that happened that would have a major effect, it would be some escalation of tensions, either between China and Japan or between China and one of its other neighbors over these territorial disputes, which and depending on what happens, that could cut either way. It could Romney could, I suppose, try to exploit that and say that this is proof of the feckless administration, or Obama could respond effectively to that, and that would really take the air out of Romney's frequent criticisms.
Right.
The other thing, I guess, is there are reports that the administration is weighing options on how to retaliate against those that it believes to be responsible for the consulate attack in Benghazi. And so depending on whether they do in fact launch retaliatory strikes and what comes of that, that could conceivably redound to the benefit of the administration, or it could reinforce this perception that they're not handling the aftermath of the attack very well.
Have we essentially already priced Syria out of the picture? I mean, it still seems to me that there's, you know, there are a lot of things that could happen in a month in Syria. I mean, I would not be shocked on any given morning to wake up and find that President Assad has been either assassinated or has fled to Russia, right? I don't expect that on any given morning, but I wouldn't be stunned to find that happening. Is there anything with regards to Syria that could really, or, you know, could that just happen and it's just not going to affect the election one way or the other because we've already priced Syrian unrest into our interpretation of the foreign policy?
I don't think it would have much impact unless it were something really huge, like Assad being killed or being driven from power. If you continue to have these sorts of border skirmishes between Turkey and Syria, that will certainly get a lot of attention. People will be worried about it, but it's not really clear what that's going to change in terms of the way that the public is viewing the issue. Because the public is so strongly against the U.S. becoming involved, I think there's reluctance to jump on the bandwagon and say we must do something in response to these attacks on Turkish soil or something like that.
Now, if I could pause you just for a second there. Did you attribute any significance to, I mean, Romney, in his speech, was quite clear about identification of Turkey as an ally.
Yes.
And sort of discussions of Turkey's global orientation have become controversial in the particular foreign policy elite circles that Romney draws from, right? And especially with regards to Turkish relations with Israel. I mean, is there any significance to Romney's identification of Turkey as a clear U.S. ally in this context? Is he sending a message to his people, or is he just saying this?
On one hand, I think he's acknowledging something that's true, which is a nice change. The interest in Turkey as an ally often tends to wax and wane in Republican circles, depending on, first of all, depending on who's in the White House and depending on how Turkish relations with Israel are going. And that's where most of this anti-Turkish sentiment has come from in the last few years, almost entirely in connection with Gaza and the controversy over the flotilla and so on. And so there certainly is a faction within the Republican Party that wants to portray Obama as enabling Erdogan and enabling Islamists everywhere. But I think the way to interpret what Romney was saying about Turkey in that situation is that this is yet another example in Romney's framing of a U.S. ally that is being threatened or that is in danger because Obama isn't leading. Right? So that's why now Turkey is an ally, because Obama is abandoning them, supposedly. I mean, that would be the way that Romney would look at it, I think.
If Obama is abandoning them, they must be an ally. That's actually a really interesting way of thinking about it, right?
I mean, that seems to be the way that it works, because unless there is some sort of perceived slight, Romney doesn't actually have much to say about allied countries. If you look over his website on his statements about his foreign policy views, at best, allies in Europe and Asia get lip service. At worst, they're completely left off. You wouldn't even know that they exist. And so I think that does account for why Romney chooses to mention that a country is an ally at a certain point rather than just dismiss them, because he sees that as one of the core points of his critique.
All right. Well, I mean, do you have anything else you want to mention while we're still here?
Not, well, I think that's pretty well covered everything. I mean, the Venezuelan election was interesting. There was a lot of hope, and I think not, and there was some reason for hope that Capriles could pull off the upset victory. And in some ways, I think that would have been healthier for U.S. relations with Venezuela, because then we wouldn't have this hate figure or this person to vilify as the reason for bad relations with Venezuela. Although, if Capriles had won, Venezuela's relations with some of these pariah states and rogue states would not have changed. So I'm not sure that it would have made as much of a difference as we might have liked. But it was interesting how the opposition in Venezuela had managed to rebuild itself and become a really credible competitor after more than a decade of really not even being in the game. Or that's not entirely fair, but for a long time, they weren't very competitive.
I mean, it's interesting, Venezuela's relations with these prior states, so, I mean, particularly Iran and Russia's, I don't know, either Russia's perpetual pariah or it's just a member of the international system. I don't know how to talk about that. But that, you know, while there is this, you know, there's this strong thread of anti-Americanism that underwrites the Iranian-Venezuelan relationship, at the same time, Iranian and Venezuelan interests are pretty much diametrically opposed, right? That each country would do fabulously well if the other country collapsed, right? In terms of the consequences for oil prices, right? If Venezuelan oil production collapses, that's amazingly good for Iran. And if Iran is completely embargoed, that's amazingly good for Venezuela. And
Absolutely,
that sort of
yeah.
contradiction is not what a healthy relationship is built on, in my estimation. But and which is why I don't take that relationship very seriously.
Right. Well, and in terms of a, let's say, a security threat or a problem for the U.S., it's really not very serious. It's one of these relationships that the Iranians have cultivated in the Western Hemisphere to make it look as if they're projecting much more influence and power than they really are, and so they're cultivating ties with these, with for the most part, very poor and almost basket case countries, in the case of Bolivia or Ecuador. Or Nicaragua. So there's a desire on their part, I think, to create the illusion that they're a major international player in our backyard, in the way that we have much more influence in their backyard. But it's mostly an illusion. And one thing I think we do see is that the antagonism towards both of those countries is clearly the reason why they've. Or it's one of the main reasons why they've been drawing closer together over the last 5 to 10 years, when there's, as you say, there's not really a natural or normal reason for them to be coming together like this.
Right, and I mean, and the same sort of justification serves for Russian relations with both. Although Russian relations with both Venezuela and Iran are more complicated than are, I think, often depicted, just because I think Russia has a more sensible utilitarian take on its relations with both of these countries than it's often appreciated. But,
But, well, and I think for the Russians, Venezuela is primarily, at least in terms of doing business with them, they're a market for weapons exports. But I mean, that's one of the things that they value them for, and so they'll keep selling to them regardless.
Right, exactly, and that's especially, I mean, that is especially true given what, especially in the context of Syria, might be a limited export market for Russian weapons in the future. That, I mean, I know the Russians are concerned about the future of their military exports, given that they expect exports to both China and India to decline in the future, and they certainly expect exports to Syria to decline, finding new markets for Russian weapons. And maintaining older markets is very important to them. All right, well, I mean, this has been a fabulous conversation. We should do it again.
And thanks, Rob. That was great.
All right. Before entertaining what's yours, thank you for watching. And we will, of course, have two or three more of these before the election. Take our predictions on Biden Ryan to the bank. You know, I'm not sure how you could actually manifest that in a measurable way, but you heard it here first. Anyway, thanks very much.